Dad?
What, Hartley?
Well, you know how you give each hen house 10 acres of pasture space so the hens can do all their natural things?
Yeah, like enjoy sunshine, eat bugs and grass, and get exercise?
Well, if you give all the pasture space to the hens, there won't be any room for Rusty and me to play.
Hartley, the Wilcox farm is over 1,800 acres. We'll always have pasture for kids and hens to enjoy.
Cool. Catch you later. Rusty's waiting. Wilcox Family Farms. Locally fresh since 1909.
Seattle Kitchen is served.
Woo!
Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Katie O.
And Chef Terry Rotorow is on the road into Maui, I believe, to see his son, his oldest son.
He's a true world traveler, I feel like, this year.
Chef Terry?
Yeah.
Always has been.
Always has been, but especially this year, it seems.
I'm Tom Douglas. I'm owner of this very place that we're taping our show in called the Hot Stove Society. And we are joined by 24 of my closest friends. Thank you all for coming today. It's a very live audience. They're just ravenous, waiting for breakfast.
Look at them.
I also own many of Seattle's fine restaurants that are here in the neighborhood, including the Dahlia Lounge across the street, Carlisle Room across from the Paramount Theater, which we just put a new menu out in. I got to say, it's pretty spectacular.
Really? What's different about it?
Well, you know, before we were veg forward, and now we still are, but we have this thing called the giant rainbow plate, and it takes our five favorite vegetables of the season and serves them as a smorgasbord. When's the last time you used that word, smorgasbord?
It's been a bit of time, yeah. I'll be honest.
So that you can order, like, for your dinner, you know, just like five different vegetable presentations.
Well, and that sounds lovely because the weather is starting to get a little bit nicer. We're heading into the spring months, which generally feels very, like, fresh and exciting.
Oddly enough,
dipping into vegetables again.
Vegetables sell all the time.
They certainly do.
Yeah, people love Brussels sprouts, right? And they love squash and pumpkin soup.
I'm really wild about cabbage. I think I told you off air last week that I hope it doesn't go the way of kale, where it becomes insanely popular and then more expensive. I want my green cabbage, my green cabbage to stay just as it is.
You know, yeah, there's a cabbage lover out there. You really got to go for Savoy cabbage.
I been doing it all wrong?
Savoy cabbage, there's something about it. It's got a bite. Not bite as in flavor, but bite as in texture I really love. And that's, of course, what I make my cabbage rolls from, which I'm sure inspired your love of cabbage.
I've yet to have your cabbage rolls, Tom. I mean, I've heard about them. They sound amazing. And definitely, I'm sure that subconsciously played in my mind as I was at the grocery store, like, Tom likes cabbage rolls.
That's right. Did you make some?
I didn't. I actually used a recipe that takes the cabbage, cuts it into big, you know, wedges, either sixth or quarters, and then you just olive oil it and roast it. Yeah. And it's just like a Brussels sprout, but in this case, it's just a big wedge. It's like having a wedge salad, but a cabbage.
You know what's really good on that? You take a little pat of butter, a little fish sauce, and a little chopped fresh dill shallots that have been bronzed. You know, that kind of Vietnamese bronze shallot.
Yeah, I love those super caramelized shallots.
Really good.
Okay, I'm going to try that.
On the show today, we do have a big show today. On the show, we have our favorite taste of the week from restaurants or from our home cooking. I had a magical collard green dish that I made. We'll talk about that. Tips and tricks on how to prevent food waste at home. And, of course, we're going to go on the Tasty Trivia Tour with Food for Thought Tasty Trivia at the end of the show. We're here for 2 hours. Hang with us or get us on a podcast. It's super fun. And I've been hearing more and more about people who have been podcasting us and really like the show.
Really? Yeah. Out and about on the town?
Since we're 15 years in, I figure at 20 years, we're going to make it.
I can't wait for 5 more years from now. All right, Tom, it's time to do a little ordinary to extraordinary. This is where you, all alone, since we don't have Chef Terry to help you, no assist here. You're going to take...
You think I need an assist?
I don't think so, but I know that sometimes it's comforting to have someone to bounce ideas off of, so...
Well, who are you?
I was going to say, now you've got me. I'm here with you.
You've been working out. You're bouncy.
That's true. I've really been working these gams, working on the push-up game. You too, though. You're a gym rat now.
Well,
I know.
That is a showstopper.
The record just scratched a halt.
I will say this morning I was working out in the gym across from some guy who was just like killing it. Uh-huh. And then he came, you know, he's like had 4,000 pounds in his hands walking around. You know how they do that? They just walk around.
Yeah, he's
like,
getting swole.
Dude, do not come on my side of the gym because you're making me look bad. And the guy said, his trainer said, dude, you show up every day. Own it.
Own it. That's beautiful.
I thought that was sweet. It made me get through the last 10 minutes of my 15-minute workout.
Gym camaraderie is a real thing, Tom. But let's move on to some dishes. We've totally digressed into our own personal fitness lives.
But don't tell anyone I work out. I don't think chefs are supposed to work out.
What are you talking about? You
We're
have
just
to
supposed
work
to be
out.
Plump and happy.
No. You have to counterbalance all of the many, many delicious meals that you're
just
consuming.
Promise you won't tell anyone.
I won't tell anyone. I won't tell anyone that listens to this show. All right, Tom. Are we ready for pea shoots yet?
Sure.
How do you make some extraordinary pea shoots?
I think you put them on top of a salad of albacore sashimi with crispy green onion pancakes and wasabi, tabico, and a little soy sauce dressing, and then you put a little pea shoot salad right on top.
Now, if anyone's been to Etta's, that dish has been... How long has that dish been on that menu?
23 years.
23 years. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That dish is almost my age.
You know what that means? That means Loretta is 25 years old, or 28 years old.
28 years old. Yeah. Does she love that dish?
She doesn't love being 28, I can tell you that.
It gets harder as you get older.
She does love that dish.
But that is a delicious dish. Mm. I always have a good chuckle about those green onion pancakes because they're not your traditional green onion
pancakes.
They
are a sneaky version.
Yeah.
They're flour tortillas with an egg wash that has a little sesame oil in it. Mm-hmm. So then I take a flat tortilla, I egg wash it with the sesame oil egg wash, which is just a beaten egg, right?
Right.
Then I put green onions in there with sesame seeds, and then I fold it over and pan fry it. And it's my cheater green onion pancake.
And if you wanted to be super cheap at home and you didn't want to buy that fish, you could just make that pea shoot salad and have
those
delicious green onion pancakes.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
You know what? I always keep a little pickled ginger in my fridge. Mm-hmm. And so just a little pickled ginger and pea shoot filling in those pancakes. Yum.
Let's talk about pickles, actually, because that's on our list of ordinary to extraordinary. How do you make an extraordinary pickle? You've got 1 minute.
And that's why they're called quick pickles, right?
Right.
So I cut up all my cucumbers or whatever I'm pickling into little bite-sized chunks, and I put on the stove at the same time rice vinegar, a little bit of honey in there, or barley malt syrup, or some sort of sweetener, coconut nectar, and salt, and that's it. Maybe toasted coriander seeds. Sometimes I'll put in one of my seedy rubs, like the roast rub or the veggie rub.
Sure.
And then that's my seasoning. And then, boom, just pour it over top. Wait for an hour. Quick pickle.
Yum.
We did that in like 45 seconds.
You're so good at this. Yes. You must have been doing this for 15 years.
Up next, we're going to talk about our taste of the week, both things maybe we've had out or things that maybe we made last week at home on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome. We are back in the Seattle kitchen at the Hot Stove Society. We do have a live audience, and you too could be in that audience if you'd like, by going to hotstovesociety.com and purchasing a ticket for $15.
Tom, what do they get for that $15?
For $15, you get a hot cup of coffee. You get this fantastic radio show live and in your face.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part of the morning.
Yes.
A hot Dahlia Bakery English muffin-based breakfast sandwich.
Crispy off the griddle.
Crispy off the griddle. And they're only clapping because they haven't got their breakfast.
Exactly.
As soon as they're sated, they will probably ditch us.
Quietly exiting stage left.
One thing I want to mention, we just announced here at the Hot Stove a junior chef camp. So ages 10 to 15. It is July 9th. Monday, July 9th through Friday, July 13th from 9 a.m. in the morning till 2 p.m. in the afternoon. Like I said, 10 to 15 years old. There's going to be plenty of hands-on cooking. We'll pack some delicious food for your... We'll pack up some delicious food that the chefs make each day. So, in other words, there'll be something to take home. Camp will be taught by our talented instructor, Bridget Charters. She's good with the kids, and she has a kid herself of that age.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been a culinary instructor for 20-plus years.
That's right.
She really knows how to do it.
Well-versed.
It's going to be dumplings, breads, pizzas, pastry, pasta, breakfast, Taco Tuesday, and super cool sushi. OMG.
Wait a second. I like Taco Tuesday, but I think I'm out of the age range by about double the age.
Okay.
All right.
Culinary taste of the week.
Ooh, this is fun. We, you know, we normally talk about what we eat out, but now that we've opened it up to things that maybe we can make and inspire others to make at home, my big mission over the last week has been to tell everyone to stop buying flour tortillas and make your own flour tortillas.
Really?
Yes. It's not as easy, certainly, as opening up the package and heating them up. But it's certainly not hard, and the results, I think, are exponentially better than what you get at the store.
Because why? Because I think of them as just being flour and water and salt, basically.
Well, there's lard in this particular recipe, so I think that gives it a flakiness, a little bit like a green onion pancake, like a Chinese green onion pancake. So I think they're a little bit more tender. They're a little bit more flaky. They're just slightly more interesting. You can control the level of salt you want. And just like any fresh product, it's just a little bit nicer when they're hot off the griddle. And the self-satisfaction. I'm not going to lie. A lot of these things, you know, when you're making a tonkotsu broth like I did the other day, or if you're making chili where you're toasting and grinding your own chilies, part of it is the satisfaction of the process of knowing that you've been eating kind of this thing since forever and you're bothering to make it from start to end.
Did you put something on this tortilla that was magical?
Oh, I made fajitas. I'm a big fajita fan.
Didn't that take away all the, like, when you put onions and beef and everything, don't you lose the delicacy of the tortilla?
That's ridiculous. That's like saying, like, making your own dumpling wrappers are ruined because you put, like, pork filling in them.
Well,
you still get
sort of are. It's just water and flour.
I'm gonna punch you in the face, Tom Douglas.
You gotta
stop it right now.
Tina,
I'm trying to get people
delicious
to make
let's
flour
just
tortillas.
Ignore her for
yeah,
a second.
Let's ignore me.
You made
Tina.
Something delicious, or you found something delicious. This
I
week?
Don't like it when mommy and daddy fight.
I know it's tough.
I actually didn't make anything delicious at all, but I went to a delicious spot, a new tasting room downtown, Brown Family Vineyards. Has a tiny little tasting room, and it was quite lovely and delicious. It's 5 tastes for $10, and they waive it if you buy a bottle of wine. And you don't usually get a taste, you know, like have a little tasting room in an urban area. And I had one of the most delicious rosés I've had in a long time. It was a Grenache rosé. And, you know, I have
from
to
Brown
say...
Brown Family Vineyards?
Brown Family Vineyards, okay. Yeah. And one of the things that I really liked about it, the chairman of the board was there, and he sat down with us and chatted about the winery and their wineries in Walla Walla. And it gave you kind of that, like, nice little country feel, even though you're in the middle of downtown Seattle. So I highly recommend checking out Brown Family Vineyards. What?
I'm just saying.
Oh, now I'm going to get it.
We've got a
for a winery
today.
To have a chairman of the board, that's not that small a winery, I don't think. Something tells me.
He was there, and he was quite there. Sweet to sit down with us and hang out, and, you know, he had no reason to. I was with 3 of my friends, so he hung out and educated us a bit about the wines.
Probably
and
3 pretty girls at a winery. No
yeah, reason. It was sweet.
All right, that's Brown Family Vineyards, the current vintage, 17 rosé.
This was, yeah, I think so. Okay. Actually, I didn't take the year, but I'm pretty sure.
All right, Tom, let's hear it so we can all scoff at you now.
Don't you wish.
Exactly, you wish. Right. Let's give what kind of hard time can we give him?
Totally.
Well, when you make something perfect, it's kind of hard to get.
Oh, here we go.
When you're a professional chef with many, many decades in kitchens.
Yeah, exactly. So I was watching the Masters, and I made barbecue, and it's not really, I don't think it's... Might have been last Sunday, but maybe it was 2 Sundays ago. But I made collard greens because I was walking. There's a QFC right near my house, and I was walking through the produce aisle, and the collard greens caught my eye because they were so spectacular.
And what made them extra spectacular?
Well, I will say that they were really small, which is unusual. A lot of times you see collard greens, they're as big as a red chard leaf. You know,
right.
they're more like... an oversized green something, and
like
especially
a palm almost.
Yeah, I mean they can be very large and they can look kind of beat up and not really pristine. These were small leaves. They looked a little bit like guilan. They had some stems on them still, and it looked a little bit like guilan, which is a Chinese broccoli with shoots coming off the stalk in a different way, say, than a crown of broccoli, right? But anyway, so big leaves or small leaves. Super pristine shape, which told you that they weren't in the organic aisle. They were in the
conventional,
highly pesticide aisle. But I saw them. I love collard greens. I made them. I took them home. I sweated an onion a little bit further than just sweat. I just put a little caramel on the onion and sliced onion. And then I put all the greens in, mm-hmm. the leaves. I de-stemmed them. And I put a can of diced tomatoes in there.
Yeah.
A little swig of a dark molasses.
I like that you called it a swig.
Yeah. A little swig of dark molasses. And then some... Chipotle Tabasco, just for some heat against the molasses, against the greens, and then big chunks of chopped garlic.
Yum.
I like garlic sometimes. It's not minced. I like big, seeable
chunks.
I'm
with you on that. Yeah. Sometimes when you start mincing it too fine, it's almost overpowering. It takes over too much of the stock, I think.
It just becomes part of the background, and yeah. I wanted it to be part of the foreground.
Yeah.
And which, so when you get a bite of the garlic, even though it's super cooked, mm-hmm. so it's not going to be in your face, it's mm-hmm. still, you know you're eating garlic.
Yum.
So then I just put a lid on and braised it for a bit.
Maybe is how long?
Maybe an hour,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, like old-fashioned, I mean, that's a lot, and it was super low,
mm-hmm.
But they just came out spectacular, and the tomatoes worked, everything worked. Don't you love a dish when you're thinking, like, you're kind of throwing it together, and you're kind of thinking, yeah, this sounds really good to me if I do it this way, and then I would say, even cooking for a living.
Right.
It's rare when you don't have to make some sort of adjustment. It's rare when it's
That's
just
true.
Perfect first time out.
Right. First time out especially. But yeah. I think, you know, what you have on your side is some intuitive qualities around, like, when you're putting that dish together, you understand that you've got the acid from the tomatoes that you're going to balance out with the molasses, that, you know, you get some smoky notes.
You're going to perk up with the chipotle.
Yeah, exactly. The smokiness from the chipotle. That also has the vinegar in it. So,
uh-huh.
you know, I think that there's a lot of wisdom behind putting together a dish that can come out correct
right.
and delicious the first time out of the gate.
And if you see in the grocery store anymore, there's a lot of smoked salts out there. That's
mm-hmm.
a good time to use a smoked salt. They're not overpowering at all. But again, it just adds that little bit of a layer of like, this is earthy and good.
Thank you for reminding me on that, because I do have a big box of Maldon smoked salt that I never seem to use.
I know. Up next, it's questions from you, our favorite listeners, many of them here in the room today on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Hey, it's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. We're here every week with you, Saturday and Sunday, 2 hours each day, sometimes even more, sometimes a little less.
Or whenever you want us on podcast.
There you go. Let's take a second to talk about Aunt Betty.
Aunt Betty.
Shall we? Because Aunt Betty represents to me the best of the best in the world, which is people who decide to take care of their village.
Mm-hmm.
And Aunt Betty bequeathed a bunch of cash to us at Food Lifeline to help us build our warehouse, and we appreciate that. And we met her right through this very radio show, which
Isn't
is
that
why
crazy?
We pick it up here at the show. But anyway, it's good to remember that people are hungry on a daily basis, not just at Thanksgiving and Christmas. So I know in our household, we tried to make a donation every month. So we would encourage any of you listening to do the same on a little monthly basis, even if it's $10 a month,
yeah,
$25
bucks every
a
little
month,
bit helps.
$1 million a month, whatever you can do.
A million would be preferable, but if you've only got 10, that's great too.
I just think it's good to be, that little $10 is a gentle reminder that we're not alone in this world.
That's right.
Exactly.
Very much.
We have a village. Helps us to take care of each other. Yay! So we have some questions.
That's right. We have questions from our listeners, some which are in our live audience right now, and some from our Facebook page. Tom,
yeah.
Let's hit it, all right? The first one comes from Ardith. She's here in our audience. Can you wave at us, Ardith? Where are you? Right in the back there. And she says, do you have any tricks or suggestions for making a delicious French onion soup? I bet she is so sad that Thierry Rotrou is not here because he makes a very delicious French onion soup. Tom?
Well, in a funny way, this is where Terry and I disagree sometimes. Because of... I'm not sure, but I think it's partly his style and partly because he's bound by tradition and
yeah.
and things like that. So, and I say bound by it. He's not anymore, but he was brought up in a certain way to make onion soup. You're taught that, and that's the way it is.
Yep.
And for me, as an American chef, French onion soup doesn't mean the same thing as it does to him, right? I know mm-hmm. What kind of the elements
you know, the
are, the soup
is.
And the bread and the cheese
mm-hmm.
and blah, blah, blah. But how I get there might be very different than how Terry would get there.
Very true. So
yeah.
How would you get there, Mr. Douglas?
I I am more of a brothy person. To me, there's two ways to do it. One is if you want that, what Terry does, which is that very reduced, intense, kind of heavy, almost syrupy kind of French onion soup, which is luscious and delicious.
Mm-hmm. It almost leaves a film in your
mouth.
Yeah,
it's so good. It's so intense.
Good, yeah.
I prefer that, say, in a little bit flatter bowl mm-hmm. with a little bit of a crouton, and then really the bread and the cheese is at least 50% of that bowl of soup.
I would agree.
And that's and serve it like kind of like an appetizer uh-huh. or something. If I'm going for French onion soup, like just for a bowl of soup, then I like to make it a little brothier,
mm-hmm.
and I like to use a mixture of onions. So I'll use a little bit of leek, a little bit of Walla Walla sweet, a little bit of shallot,
mm-hmm.
and I'll just make a combination of onions, and I'll put the crouton in, and I'll put the cheese on, and I'll finish it.
The whole family of onions, like a little family reunion.
Yeah, and I won't reduce the veal stock. I mean, traditionally it's made with veal stock.
Right.
I won't reduce it. I could even make it with reduced chicken stock for a little bit less intensity,
mm-hmm.
less viscosity. But to me, there's lots of ways to go about making French onion soup, and so it's more about where you want to end up. If you're making it as your entire meal, which is, you certainly could, right, because
yeah,
of that cheese and bread, then maybe go with the richer version.
Right.
But if it's like a starter, I like a little bit lighter.
How important do you think it is in this particular case to be making your own broth? I mean, there are so many other very rich elements between the onions or whatever it is that you're using from that family, mm-hmm. the Allium family, the cheese, the bread. Mm-hmm. Where does the stock fall into this?
So this goes back to the question when you said you were making your tortilla, which you said that I was trashing you over.
Yeah,
about
quit trashing
blah, blah,
my
blah,
tortilla.
Which was not at all. Loved mm-hmm. it. But this, to me, is where you make that distinction sometimes about where you want your effort, right?
Right.
An onion soup is all about the broth. And so, yeah, making it homemade and making it the way you like it and to the viscosity that you like.
It matters.
Now it matters.
Yeah.
A tortilla with a bunch of fajitas and blah, blah, blah.
I just cannot let this tortilla go.
It might not be as important because you're not going to get the distinction.
That's it. I'm making you fajitas. We're getting together. You're making cabbage rolls and I'm making fajitas. All right. We're moving on to the next question. This one comes from Anita. Anita, can you wave at us? Great. Fabulous. I'm having a little bit of trouble deciphering this, but I think what it says is, when can I add a ham to dried beans, considering salt should not be added to the until the last few minutes of cooking those mm-hmm. beans. Now, I've heard that this whole salting of beans is a myth. But, Tom?
Well, maybe while we're chatting, Tina could look up to see if salting beans is a wives' tale or
can
not.
Can you look up Kenji Alt Lopez on Serious Eats? He has a whole really wonderful article mm-hmm. on this particular topic.
And he says it's a myth.
He says it's a myth because I was looking up chili recipes.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, obviously there's a controversy whether you add those beans to begin with or not. So,
uh-huh.
you know, full stop there. But there was a whole piece on beans and whether you salt them or not, and does that actually make them more mealy? And he did a side-by-side scientific test, as he does, and the beans that were soft and tender and luscious but still intact were actually, in fact, the salted beans.
So I wouldn't disagree with Kenji on that, not knowing it scientifically, but
mm-hmm.
I would just go to his background, right? America's Test Kitchen. His book, what's it called? Food Lab.
Yep.
The guy is a scientist.
He's rigorous.
He's really good about doing things side by side and getting rid of old wives' tales.
Mm-hmm.
He's why I now have no problem cooking a steak from frozen or a rack of lamb from frozen. I mean, he proved it to me right here in this very kitchen,
yeah.
at Hot Stove. We talked about that and did that. So.
The proof is in the pudding in that particular case. If you use his recipes, you'll find that they're solid. Yes, Tina?
I will put this article, because it's a bit complicated,
yeah.
on our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. But the upshot is, he says, as it turns out, despite absorbing more liquid, unsalted beans are actually much more prone to bursting out of their skins than salted beans are. And more importantly, salted, both the soaking water and the cooking water, seems to help.
Yeah,
so
I think there's
a
bit of
osmosis, but I'll put it up.
Situation.
So let's go back to the ham and the soup then. So
yes.
I would say if you're putting ham in the soup, I would just put it in the soup, if it's just the ham, towards the end, because I don't want it overcooked. I want to have a nice bite to the ham and a creamy
mm-hmm.
bite that you get. But if you cook it a long time, it'll start to get stringy and dry out. So then if I'm putting a ham bone or a ham hock in the ham soup, then I'll put it right in the beginning and let that whole thing kind of cook and carry. And like when I make black bean soup, we have a well-known black bean soup we used to serve at Cafe Sport and still do at Etta's. That ham hock comes out, and it's falling off the bone, and it's so delicious. And so then I would put that right in at the beginning. So
all right. I hope that helps. So ham bone or hock in the beginning. If it's just the meat, just throw it in at the end.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's another question from Marsha in our audience. I'm making crab meat mornay for a party. How much in advance can I make the cheese sauce? Will it reheat? There's
crab
Marcia.
Meat
She's
mornay.
Waving.
So are you putting it, just you can shake your head yes or no, are you putting the crab meat on, say, a piece of bread before you put the mornay on, or is it just on the platter and then the mornay sauce over top? In a chafing dish. Okay. It's not going to break. Mornay is typically a bechamel, which is the floured cream sauce.
Emulsified sauce.
Cheese into it. But once you put cheese in it, you really don't want to boil it anymore. You can reheat it. It's almost like what you're making mac and cheese with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just wouldn't boil it because depending on the amount of cheese, if you have a lot of cheese in your mornay, then you might separate the fat from the whey of the cheese. And even with the flour, it might not hold it. And it also might just get a little bit of a glisten or a little greasiness on top if you overheat it. But if it should be, and you frankly, you don't want to get it that hot with the crab meat because the crab meat will just drain all of its natural moisture and be soupy and not very good.
So perhaps the answer is, if you want to make this in advance, to make the bechamel, and if you want to cool that. And then when you're ready to finally assemble the mornay, can she have the cheese already shredded and all that sort of stuff, add it to the mornay, slowly reheat that, fold in the crab meat, and then serve?
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go.
Be good.
Yeah.
And you might even, if you put the mornay on top, you might even take a kitchen torch and just kind of give it a glaze. And that cheese should brown up a little bit, give you a little color on the top. Maybe hit it with some smoked paprika, you know, that Spanish beautiful smoked paprika.
All right. We have one quick one. We have just enough time for Megan Dutcher's question from Facebook. What is your current favorite condiment? Hers right now is chimichurri, she says. Tom?
Current favorite condiment. I think preserved cabbage, like Chinese preserved cabbage. It's salty, it's unctuous, it's cheap, it sprinkles on pan-fried noodles beautifully.
Yeah,
so
delish.
I just think people don't use it very much because they're afraid of it. It looks weird, but it's good.
It is a little strange. Once you start getting into those pickled cabbages and kimchis and things, people get a little...
This is salted, though. This is not pickled as much as
I don't know that I'm
salted.
Familiar with this.
Yeah.
I look forward
had
to
it last
trying
night
it
on my spicy pork with preserved cabbage at King Noodle House. It's pretty darn good.
Look at you. Taste of the week. Here we are again.
Up next, food and the news. Katie, I hope you have a big list for us. Because
we have a huge list.
I've worked out this one. I mean, I didn't really work out. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to say that. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
You're listening to Seattle Kitchens On Demand, brought to you this week by Bonide. Check out the Bonide family of products for all your gardening needs. Whether it's bugs or weeds, there's a Bonide product to help. Find out more about Bonide and a dealer near you at Bonide.com.
All right, here we go. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. And we're here at the Hot Stove Society just waiting on our breakfast sandwiches from the Dahlia Bakery. What was the winner today, the mushroom or the bacon or the ham?
It was the mushroom, Tom.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
I think it's because you're an influencer, Tom. I think when you pick your sandwich, the audience is like, well, that must be the good one.
Oh, I see.
I think that's what's
going on. Are people
going
to pay me like to come around the country and be an influencer? That's the hot thing these days.
I think Tina's got something lined up for us so that we can figure out how we can be influencers because being on the show I don't think is enough these days. I don't think we've influenced
It seems really enough. Expensive when I write the check to you every month.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel like you're getting a great deal. Difference of opinions.
I guess so.
Okay, on to food in the news.
Food in the news. This is where we comb
Tina,
the internet.
Katie seems to be complaining, and maybe we need to do something about this.
I'm feeling very feisty today.
How long is her contract?
I think the tortilla conversation.
What's story number one, Katie?
Tina doesn't want to let go of me. She loves me so much. All right. Food in the news. This is where we comb the internet and, I guess, periodicals that show up on the internet for the best food stories. This one comes from the New York Times. It's a little bit more of an inspiration question, which is an article based on five New York Times writers on what they got right and wrong in the early 90s. And they go on to talk about all matter of things in the arts and whatnot. But We thought we'd put a little food spin on this and ask you, what are some opinions you once held on food, maybe recipes or restaurants that have changed over the years, Tom? Deep questions. This is like a therapy session.
That is. Now I am going to have to give you a raise.
just to work out some of these demons.
Yeah.
I mean, was there anything that you were just like adamantly against coming up in the industry that you feel much differently about now?
I would probably say spa food always kind of rubbed me wrong in the beginning.
Well, California cuisine was probably pretty
California
pretty
cuisine
hot, right?
I liked. Yeah. That was I latched that on the, to that right away. But California cuisine, in my opinion, was more about being a little bit more ethnically diverse, mm-hmm. but also using local ingredients and blah, blah, blah. Spa cuisine was really about minimalism as far as portion size goes. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I should have gotten more of the spa cuisine because I'm kind of a big dude. Yep. I just thought it was kind of, you know, it was made fun of a lot by established chefs at the time. And then I like the way it's infiltrated into reasonable portion size. One of the things I would say is if you look at places like the Cheesecake Factory or Claim Jumper or some of these restaurants that serve portions, even some of the steakhouses serve massive steaks.
That are known for big portions.
Yeah, really. I find that kind of thing disgusting. And I really don't think you should be buying tomorrow's dinner tonight. You know, is thinking about, oh, I don't mind paying for this or doing this because I have a doggy bag for tomorrow's dinner.
Right.
That, I don't like that whole mentality. Mm-hmm. And that seems like very much a... It came about in the 90s of these massive portions.
Did you ever have feelings about, like, the modernist movement? I mean, a lot of people did, and it was a little bit of a polarizing thing that is not too far back in our culinary history.
Yeah. I don't really have a feeling about it. Mm-hmm. It's not something I've embraced outside of I've loved the books, you know, and I love looking at it. But it's not something I've integrated it as much into my food. Oddly enough, Jackie, my wife, has integrated it more because of her farm dinners at Prosser.
Oh, interesting.
Dev was really, our farm manager was really into it. And so mm-hmm. She kind of got the same bug. And so I'm not against it. It's just not something I practice a ton.
Right. Right, right. Okay, Tom, moving on to the next article. This one comes from NPR. It's Why MasterChef UK is Uniting Malaysians in Outrage. Do you know about this? Have you heard about this?
No, tell me about it.
Essentially, there is a dish that was being judged on MasterChef. If you're familiar with MasterChef, home cooks, semi-professional cooks compete against one another in front of a panel of judges. And in this particular case, they made a traditional Malaysian dish, which is called chicken rendang. Have you had this dish?
I don't think so.
I don't think I've had it either. Mm-hmm. But essentially what the issue was is it was criticized by its inedible skin. Now, the thing about this dish is that it doesn't have a luscious, crispy skin. That's kind of the point of it. You mm-hmm. know, it's a very cultural thing. And so Malaysians and Indonesians are kind of banding together to say, like, who are you to judge our ethnic cuisine?
Who was the judge?
Cuisine? Great question.
Was it essentially what it sounds like is that they probably brought over a British judge or somebody who didn't know much about that.
Yeah, it was a UK judge, Greg Wallace. Yeah. And so part of what we're curious about to get your opinion on is you've been a judge on food shows before. Mm-hmm. You've done this thing. So what happens when something is presented to you that has...
Ethnically correct, but... unpleasing to me.
Yeah, like culturally, it's just not something mm-hmm. that you're a fan of. Like, I think a lot of people have a certain vision of what Chinese food is, but actually a lot of Chinese food is actually very texturally based, right? Mm-hmm. And textures that maybe we as Americans, North Americans, don't really super duper love. Like
or understand.
Or understand, yeah. You know.
Sushi was very much like that, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And now it's hugely popular, but it takes a bit. So,
here's what I would say about that. Personally, Mr. Wallace should have researched the dish before he was presented with it. I'm sure he knew what they were making. Mm-hmm. I have been on these food shows enough to know that they have an agenda. And so they could have even been setting him up, who knows, mm-hmm. For this kind of conflict.
For ratings and
because
things.
It's getting some worldwide attention, right? So,
I mean, we're talking about a show neither of us have seen, ultimately.
Right.
MasterChef.
So that's, you know, sometimes that's the agenda based on the show. I would hate if they hung him out to dry that way, but... In his own way, he should have done some research and realized mm-hmm. what the dish was supposed to be. When I was on Iron Chef, And Chef Morimoto did, you know, we had salmon. We did battle salmon, right? And
right.
He took it a whole different direction than what I was expecting him to. He only did really what I thought of one thing being super Japanese, which he, of course, is Japanese.
Yeah.
And I felt like even though I didn't go Japanese, my food was more in nature of what I consider Japanese, simply prepared, mm-hmm. using all of the fish. And he was making gnocchi out of a fish. And I think salmon cabbage rolls or fish cabbage rolls are, might be pretty traditional over there. But
yeah.
My favorite dish that he did was this piece, a slab of salmon on a cedar shaving almost, mm-hmm. and then just did hot oil over the top, right?
Ooh, I bet that was good.
It was good. But then his other dish was beets with salmon and brown sugar, you know, cured. And
you hate beets to begin with.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That was never gonna
I think one of the
you.
Reasons I won was I was a little bit, in an odd way, a little bit more Japanese, traditional Japanese in that simplicity than he was.
Right.
Weirdly.
Sometimes, you know, being culturally relevant within that area of cuisine has, you just need to take one element sometimes, mm-hmm. whether it's the ingredients that make it culturally relevant or a technique or an idea. But following that through, I think, is kind of an interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting thing to touch on.
I put it on him. He either let the producers do it to him or he didn't prepare himself well enough for that show.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough.
I think they have something to complain about.
Do we have time for one more article?
We don't.
We don't. We only have 30
seconds. Sean already gave me the...
I got to look at Sean more often for the cues. You're behind me.
okay. Holy smokes, we have a few of those articles to save for next time, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Up next in hour two, a dinner party using scallops in every course. That is going to be a challenge, considering we always have to have some sort of cocktail.
Mmm, scallop cocktail.
Mmm, I know just what I'm going to do with that if you are incapable.
I feel like I've got one in my mind
okay.
already.
You're listening to us on Cairo Radio. Please hang with us. We're here for another whole hour on 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It is the Hot Stove Society. We do have a live audience, but they're in a coma because they haven't had their breakfast yet.
Oh, my gosh.
Yay.
We're going to have to resuscitate everyone with their breakfast sandwiches.
Exactly. We are Tom and Katie O.
That's right. We are without Mr. Thierry Rotrow, Chef Thierry Rotrow. He's on one of the beautiful islands of Hawaii with his son and wife and his son's lovely fiance.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And so we really do hate him right now.
We do. We're incredibly jealous. It doesn't feel fair that he didn't invite us, but so be it. We're here together.
A lot of people think, you know, we get all this comments that I don't like Thierry, and of course it's not true. We like to kid each other.
Of course.
But right now, I really don't like Thierry.
You really don't like him.
Yeah.
But you know what's so sweet about that? It's because you're not with him. That's really sweet.
Okay.
Too sappy. All right, moving on. It is time to have a dinner party, mm-hmm. Tom. And we're going to host it here at the Hot Stove Society because we need some elbow room. We're already here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not hosting at my house because I have to cook.
Yeah, you do, because Chef Terry's gallivanting.
He's gallivanting about.
Mm-hmm.
And as we do, we have a special ingredient that we're going to use in every course. You teased it out in the last hour, and it's going to be scallops. Mm-hmm. Although I'm going to put you on the spot this time. Who's the guest going to be?
Oh, who's the guest? It's Ariel.
Ariel from The Little Mermaid.
Yeah. Ariel, because she's awesome. She can swim really good, and she turns into a princess or something like that.
And that's pretty cool to have a princess over. Mm-hmm. That was one of my favorite movies as a kid. Does that make you feel old? How old were you when that movie came out?
It doesn't make me feel old because I had a daughter who loved Ariel.
Oh,
blah,
that's
blah,
true.
Blah. But you know what makes you feel old is when I use dried scallops. Because that's what I'm going to use in the first course with my cocktail.
What?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, let's hear it.
We're going to infuse vodka with dried scallops. And if you've ever been to Hong Kong and go through the open markets in Hong Kong, you see lots of markets that just have dried fish. And
mm-hmm.
squid, sea cucumber, lots of scallops, all sorts of things that are dried. Because they use them as kind of soup bases or they like the texture when they're rehydrated.
Uh-huh.
We were talking about shiitake mushrooms, right?
Yeah.
Dried. There's a gelatinous quality when you rehydrate previously dried things. And so I'm going to make a scallop vodka.
Ooh.
It's going to be so good.
That is a savory
vodka.
Yeah,
and Ariel loves it because I'm going to put a rim of Aleppo pepper kind of around the edge. So Match her hair, exactly. And then we're going to serve that with some of her little sea beans. You know those salty sea beans
Ooh,
that we get right here on the tide flats here? Those are just going to be our little cocktail appetizer with our dried scallop martini.
Woo-hoo!
And a little spice and Ariel. Despite the fact that her relatives are in the glass, she's going to really enjoy the cocktail.
This is taking a very dark turn very quickly.
Well, we just dried her relative. Her friends.
Strange fan fiction going on. All right, moving on. I'm no professional chef, so I'm going to come up with some ideas, and hopefully you can help me kind of like whittle them out, suss them out, flesh them out, whatever the right word is for it.
That's
with
after
me?
Dinner.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I would love to do, Tom, for our kind of salad appetizer-y course, is a nice like thin slice, like ceviche,
crudo
style scallop. I want a little bit of freshness, maybe some sort of citrus in there, but then I want something kind of crispy to change up the texture so it's not just that kind of soft, luscious scallop. What are you thinking?
Well, that, you know, I like when you put that thinly sliced scallop.
So pretty, right?
Along on the plate, right?
And then you kind of... A little translucent. It's so thin.
And then you start dressing from there. And my, you know, favorite place that I have that kind of food is at La Bernardin in Manhattan, right? He makes beautiful crudos.
Oh, Eric.
And just
Eric
does, you just do it with a little drizzle of great olive oil, maybe a grind of pink peppercorn.
Very
some
pretty.
Some citrus supremes. And that's going to be what's going to be part of your salad and part of your cure on the fish, right? Because you want to give it 15 minutes or so to kind of, like ceviche, just cook it, let the citrus cook the scallops
just a
touch. And that's it. Walk away.
Walk away.
Use a great crunchy Maldon salt or something that has a big crispy crunch to it. You don't need anything else.
Any light herbs at all, like a little celery leaf
they're
or
too,
anything?
They're too strong for the scallops.
Too much. Just let it be.
Honestly,
it be
celery leaf.
As it is.
Anything like that is just too strong
too
for those
much.
Scallops, in
okay.
my opinion.
I like it.
If you're
going
to go an herb, you have to go something lightly flavored, like chervil or something that really plays with the scallop.
Okay. I think your turn now is the main scallop course.
Main scallop course.
Oh, my gosh. Does this mean I have dessert?
I think
I'm already freaking out. Okay.
You know, one of the things that was really popular when I first moved here, and they were in the market all the time, were the big piles of what they called Vancouver Island singing scallops.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just these tiny little guys. And apparently when the divers went after them, they'd move en masse. And the noise they made, you know, when they were moving their shelves to move their bodies – made a little kind of singing noise. And so doing those kind of like just steamed scallops with the coral still on them and in a bowl with butter and wine and big loaf of garlic bread, I think that would be a perfect light.
I would eat so many of those.
I know.
All of them.
Yeah.
Just scooping it up and sopping up that sauce with the bread. That sounds delicious.
A little Washington Semillon.
I think I'm going to do I figured out what I'm going to do for dessert.
Really?
It's going to be whimsical.
It would have to be with scallops.
And Ariel, too. So we're not actually going to use scallops, but we're going to make a dessert that looks like a scallop. So I'm going to take one of those beautiful singing little, scallop shells.
Uh-huh.
And instead of a scallop being in the center, when I was in Tokyo, I had... one of those beautiful pounded mochis that was so soft and tender.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to make that somehow. I'm going to figure out how to make this.
A little faux scallop.
A little faux scallop with that beautiful pounded mochi, maybe a little red bean inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be
red bean
little,
coral. You know, scallops have that little orange coral.
Exactly. And that's
how smart is that, you all?
That's going to be our dessert.
Let's hear it for Katie O for thinking outside the box.
Then we don't have to suffer through a weird scallop dessert that no one wants to eat.
But you use the shell and you've made a faux scallop with mochi. I think that's brilliant.
We did it.
Boy.
Do you think Ariel's happy? Is she going to bring her little friends, Flounder and Sebastian?
I know. She's happy we didn't cook the fish along with the scallops.
That's true. We could have very
although
well
although I do love Flounder.
And I do love lobster.
And you do love lobster.
So there's that.
I think she'll be happy. We only ate part of the zoo.
That's true. Sebastian's a crab. I correct myself.
Is he a crab or a lobster?
I think he's a crab.
Okay.
He's just red, which is weird.
And typically what you do is you hack up a lobster or hack up a crab.
Uh-huh.
Our
sure
next
do.
Segment is going to be called Hacking It Up, Food Hacks that you might want to try here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen. I'm Katie O here with Chef Tom Douglas, and Terry Rotrow is out doing the hula.
Hula.
I don't know what he's doing, but he's in Hawaii. So.
Have you been to my friend Keith Robbins' new hula hula up on Kapahoa?
I was there on opening night.
Oh, were you?
Yes. Yes, I was doing
such a playa.
I was doing some R&D for some large format tiki cocktail beverages, you know, like the ones that you share and get very drunk off of. So they had just happened to open. So, yeah, I've been there. It's great. It's fantastic. I think they have coconut shrimp, which, you know, we're all a fan.
I love a good trashy coconut.
That's right. Anyway, we are moving into hacks in the kitchen. We actually touched on this a couple weeks ago about hacks that can make maybe your life a little easier, some in the kitchen or grocery shopping or what have you. But Tom, you're a professional, so we like to get your take on these sorts of things. All right. So the first one is, if your buttermilk is about to expire, use an ice cube tray to salvage the leftovers. Well, a lot of recipes, not a lot, but there are some recipes that really specifically call out buttermilk. Mm-hmm. And more than likely, that's pretty much all that people are using it for is that one recipe. So you're saddled with the rest of your buttermilk. So they're saying if you don't have a way to use it, just store it in ice cube trays. Thoughts on this?
Well, I think that that's certainly doable. I don't see why you don't just throw the whole container of buttermilk in your freezer. It'll freeze fine. As it is in that little container, so that's not. I don't know why you'd bother with the ice cube trays. Secondly, if you have buttermilk, it's kind of like when you deep fry at home, right? If you start the fryer and you're making French fries tonight, well, then tomorrow night you need to make something like fried squid or something. You need to get a second use out of that oil, or it's just too expensive.
Right.
Right. So just do it. But even that oil will last. If you put it back in the container, put it in the fridge, that oil will last quite a long time, too.
Let's talk about this buttermilk, though, for a second. Because, like, I can only think of a couple of things off the top of my head. One being, like, buttermilk.
You need
fried
a taller
chicken.
Head, I think.
I guess so. But
okay, so let's just say.
Let's just say.
So you bought the buttermilk for fried chicken, right? Mm-hmm. Most likely you used a whole pint for that. But let's just say you have half a pint left. Aren't you making cornbread? And that cornbread says use milk, right? Well, use buttermilk instead. It's okay. I know. It's crazy, huh?
I feel like you're revealing
you should feel free right now.
The secrets
like, oh my
of
God.
The universe to me.
Yeah. but so, yeah, just use it up where you can. Yeah. It doesn't have to have a recipe. It's more the opposite. If you have milk but not buttermilk, you can't substitute the milk.
Mm.
But if you have buttermilk and you need milk, you could substitute the buttermilk.
See, now, I feel like that's the real hack right there.
Okay, good. We're done here.
You're super smart.
Yeah.
End of segment.
Yeah.
Okay. No, let's move on to the next one. Grate your own cheese with a sturdy cheese grater. Just like with prepackaged lettuce, grated cheese costs extra money for the convenience. Grate a large hunk of cheese and keep it in a container in the fridge for easy sprinkling.
Nonsense. Just grate it when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason you have to pre-grate the whole cube just because you've done it, right? Just close it up and it's fine. If it's going to mold, if it's going to last that long that it's going to mold, it's going to mold either grated or ungrated.
That's right. And actually much more difficult to handle that mold.
Right. And when you think about it, if you think about that chunk of cheese gathering the odors, even if it's wrapped, the odors from your fridge, it's only gathering on the four sides of that chunk of cheese.
Right.
If you think of that grated cheese sitting in there gathering the odors of your fridge, think of the exposed parts of the cheese.
Infiltrated.
Totally. OMG.
Breached that
we
cheese.
We have two food hacks that have been debunked here just right now.
I really like it.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a question for you. I was cleaning out my cheese drawer.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That sounds nasty.
It was kind of nasty. But, like, in there was a piece of Comté, which I love. But I didn't get to it fast enough because I forgot that it was even in there.
Okay.
And so there's a bit of mold. But I'm thinking to myself, like, can I cut that mold off and eat this? Is it worth it? I mean, this was an expensive piece of cheese. I get that I took it for granted and forgot about it. But can I salvage it?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And my guess is the mold wouldn't hurt you either. People freak out about it, but I don't think the mold would hurt you on that kind of mold. A lot of cheese has mold on it. Brie, that's all that camembert.
Yeah.
All
triple. That's all just mold on the outside anyway.
Yeah. So. Blue cheese. What's on the inside of blue cheese?
Injected.
Mold.
Just all mold all the time.
So,
all that beauty.
I think there is a question whether that mold's even bad, but yeah, just cut it off and keep going.
Okay. See? Look at, we've got all sorts. Look at, we've got some clapping. People are very excited about this mold on cheese situation. All right. Your next next hack, Tom. Wrap celery, broccoli, and lettuce in aluminum foil before storing in the fridge. It'll stay crisp for 4 weeks or more. What?
Boy, I just don't know why you need aluminum. Why not just the bag you bought it in, the produce bag?
I'm not sure, but do you want to keep your celery, broccoli, and lettuce for 4 weeks? I mean, I guess that's the other big
question.
Don't
be so judgmental.
I am judgy. I'm feisty today, like I said.
Sure, if it's good in 4 weeks, it's fine, yeah.
Okay. So let's all just go.
But
and
I would
wrap
just do it.
I
personally would just do it in a plastic bag.
Okay.
I think when we think about things that are bad for the environment, I think of foil as being compostable, but I also think of it being dramatic to get out of the ground in the first place. And so,
you think of foil as compostable?
Yeah, it is compostable. Yeah, but in the long term, unlike plastic, it'll break down, right? Yeah, well, mm-hmm. It won't take millions of years.
In millions of years from now, when
but
we no longer exist on this planet.
I think of it as being an organic thing that we take out of the earth. And plastic is too, but it's not compostable, right?
Okay. All right. This is a very interesting topic we've digressed to on compostable products. Tom, save and freeze your veggie scraps to make vegetable stock. Good to freeze up to 6 months? What do you think?
Sure. Absolutely.
Sure. Do you do this?
Yeah. I'll save leek tops, you know, things like that that have some sturdiness to them. I don't save carrot peelings.
Uh-huh.
Because they're just nasty after
that's
they've
just
been frozen.
Gross. Yeah. You don't need to do
but
that.
But things like if that celery and carrot in your fridge, uh-huh. that, yeah, I keep a Ziploc with the chicken backs because I break down my own chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Good way to save money.
Great way.
But then you don't want to make a stock until you have enough of them, right? So
mm-hmm.
I'll just throw in onions that are ready to go, anything like that into my stock bag.
I like this. All right, Tom, your next hack. Stop your brown sugar from turning rock hard by throwing a couple of marshmallows into the bag. Have you ever heard of this?
I have not, but I'm going to try it.
Yeah, because it is pretty annoying. You buy that big bag of brown sugar, and unlike buttermilk, unless you have a ton of ways to use brown
uh-huh.
sugar.
Yeah, I put it in ice cube trays and I freeze it.
Is that how you do that?
Yeah.
You just pre-portion out
mm-hmm.
the perfect amount of brown sugar for a recipe?
People freak out about brown sugar. You know, it breaks up easy, creams up nice. Maybe I'm missing something, but mine doesn't get rock hard like that.
Do you think there's ever a point with these things where you're like, wow, this brown sugar is rock hard? Again, I'm with you. I feel like the way that they package it these days, which is in these resealable bags, it's really hard to get it to that place. So if your brown sugar has gone to that place uh-huh. where it's like a solid rock, maybe is it just time to invest in new brown sugar?
Yeah, well, you're rich, so you can do that. You can
yes.
have that kind of scenario. But you
that's
can also
true,
put it in the
rich.
Oven, warm it up, I believe, and it softens up, if I'm not mistaken. So.
Okay. Here's our last hack.
Or this nice lady in the audience said, grate it on your grater.
Okay.
How about that? That's a good food hack.
All right.
Yeah.
I like that. The audience is coming up with their own food
hacks.
But
let's say you're putting it into your greens, right, or you're using it in barbecue sauce. That chunk will melt down.
Yeah,
right?
It doesn't
you don't
matter because you're
about.
Heating it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the last one. Back to that ice cube tray. If you can't finish a bottle of wine, freeze the leftovers in an ice cube tray.
For stock or something like that?
I don't know. Definitely not to, like, maybe a sangria? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'd say finish the bottle of wine and just sleep longer.
Yeah, man up. You can't finish a bottle of wine. You don't have any friends to pour a glass for?
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Yeah, just sleep better. Up next, it's the Baker's Corner with Dahlia Bakery chef Brittany Bartleben. We're going to jump into what makes the perfect breakfast muffin on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We have a lively group here today in the Cairo Radio Hot Stove Society Kitchen. As we do every week, we have the Baker's Corner. But first, I want to go back and announce again this Junior Chef Camp for 10 to 15-year-olds. July 9th to the 13th, right here at the Hot Stove. If you want more information, go to hotstovesociety.com. If you want to be in our audience, go to hotstovesociety.com. If you want to take one of our classes, if you want to shop in our gift shop, go to hotstovesociety.com. Or, as this nice young man asked me today about what knives to buy, you could come right here and buy the hotstovesociety.com, or not .com, hotstovesociety knives. And I'm going to buy this nice gentleman, because he asks, a knife of his choice. I have a boning knife, a bread knife, a chef knife, a santuco knife, and a paring knife. And he can choose any one of those.
Oh, I do love that paring knife. Maybe I'll buy a paring knife before I leave.
It'd be nice for you to buy something instead of just putting it into your purse and walking away.
That's my preferred method, but since I'm on air, I'll supposedly buy it.
Yeah. All right. Chef Bart Laban is here from the Dahlia Bakery, and we're in the Baker's Corner, which we try to do every week. Brittany, welcome.
Yes, Chef, good morning.
How is the end of restaurant week?
We're good.
We're good?
Yeah,
you made it.
Home stretch, we made it. It's been great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, in our world, restaurant week is not a whole lot different than anything else, other than it's the week when dessert is included in the menu.
You are forced to eat dessert.
I know.
It's,
and so,
yes.
So
a dream.
Typically,
yes.
I would say, or what would you guess, Brittany, if 10 diners came into the Dahlia, two would have dessert, maybe, or three at the outside.
Yeah.
And Dahlia is one of our higher ones.
It's our
ones.
Dessert house, technically,
And so in dessert week, if 10 diners come in, 10 diners have dessert. And so you've been a little busy for the last 2.5 weeks.
Yes, but this ain't my first rodeo, so we're well planned out and organized, so it was good. I love restaurant week.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to jump into Baker's Corner. I gave you a task because I find this to be an inconsistent area sometimes for people of breakfast muffins. They're often too dry. They're often, in my opinion, too short. Like they sink down into the little pastry cups that they're in. I like a big, you know, remember how many years ago when the muffin tops came out where people just got the muffin tops? That's my favorite part.
Yes, it's the best part.
Where that top part gets crispier around the edge.
Part, right?
I don't know.
You guys know the Seinfeld episode about the muffin tops? Yeah, it's...
I always thought it was my love handles, the muffin tops.
Those are also lovely and delicious.
Anyway, so let's start from the very beginning of how to make the perfect breakfast muffin, and then maybe some of your ideas on what those ingredients are. So there's the technique, and then there's the actual flavor profile.
I think it's very important to mention that a muffin should not be a cupcake. It should not be so sweet.
Okay.
And, you know, where a cake or a cupcake is cake batter baked individually, a muffin is quick bread baked in the individual.
It's not unfrosted cake is what you're telling
me. Exactly. And I feel like that's one place where, I mean, sometimes I think muffins are just entirely too sweet. And it's just like, this is cake.
Right.
Muffins... the technique should be basically wet into dry. So it's going to be an oil-based recipe. We're not creaming butter like we would for a cake. And that's going to make it more moist.
That's typical? Oil-based?
Oil-based. I do a little bit of melted butter in there as well for flavor. But, yeah, it's supposed to be just the easiest thing to do, spur of the moment in the morning for breakfast. So, yeah, you've got your wet ingredients, you've got your dry ingredients, and you just combine the two.
It's typically baking powder and soda. Okay.
And then some sort of acid agent that you're going to add to make the baking soda floof up.
And so buttermilk,
sour cream. I personally prefer buttermilk.
Okay.
But yeah. Sugar, you can hold back a little bit on the sugar. You don't need to go so intense, but you definitely need some. Salt, flour, eggs. That's basically it.
So now I go, but now for me, to me, it's there's some technique involved next that's going to make you successful or not. So let me just guess, because we have not talked about this, but I think the right temperature on your oven is really important, because when that thing blossoms out the top of the muffin, what do you call the muffin?
Muffin tin?
Well, yeah, but it's in a little paper
cup.
The muffin cup. And hits the tin. That to me is where the caramelization happens.
That's the best part. And the biggest mistake people make to not achieve that wonderful bulbous muffin top is just simply not filling their cups enough.
Okay.
You have to kind of overfill your muffin.
So if you're looking at your cup, you fill over the top of the paper?
Over the top. There's a little dome of raw batter that I see when I put my muffins in the oven. So that way it really grows and has a chance to sort of spill out. And that's where you've got your muffin top.
And that's where white people, they love that caramelization.
That's the best part. And you have to use a standard cupcake or muffin liner. You can't. They have these things called tulip cups now, and they're these paper cups that actually have tabs that stick out. And that you're not going to have a muffin top.
You don't get a muffin top. You don't get that beautiful edge.
They're cute, but they're
not.
They're silly.
Very en français.
Exactly. They don't know what they're doing with an American muffin.
Chef Thierry, you'd love me.
Brioche, fine.
Can you imagine a French person listening to my accent right there? They would just vomit right now. All right, so now flavor profile. So is there a magic in a muffin for you? Is there one particular muffin that you feel like epitomizes what a breakfast muffin should be? Because to me, like, everyone likes the little barley muffins because they're healthy. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, gross.
I mean, I like a bran muffin. Those are nice. But to me, what epitomizes a perfect muffin is the cranberry orange muffins my mother made when I was growing up. Huh. And she made them in these huge muffin tins, so they were just enormous. And so as a kid, it was just like, yay!
Like the Costco muffins, how big they are.
Yeah, how big they are. Yeah. Hers were homemade and delicious. But they've got that tang from the cranberries, sweetness from the oranges. Those two flavors pair beautifully together. You don't have to add a ton of sugar, but there was some. And then she would put just this, like, crunchy sugar mixture on top before putting them in the oven. Mm-hmm. And that, I know now, is two parts sugar to one part soft butter. And you just kind of mash it together with a fork, sprinkle it on your raw batter, and it creates this just crispy, sugary...
Now, that is a nice tip.
Takes that muffin top over the edge.
Just the top. You don't put it inside the...
No, just a little. It caramelizes just a little bit.
Over the edge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the cake itself was tangy, not too sweet. You get these puckery little pops of cranberry, and then that sugary, crunchy topping. That, to me, is just a perfect muffin.
Yeah. My mother didn't make very many muffins, but the one she did make was kind of like a little... more of a plain muffin, more of a cake muffin, and then she would dredge them in butter and cinnamon sugar.
That muffin is making a comeback these days.
It's making a comeback?
Yes. If you look on Instagram or social media of any kind, those are really having a moment right now.
What are they called? Why is it? So it's just like a little...
It's just a plain muffin, a plain buttermilk muffin that, when they come out of the oven, you dunk them in butter and roll them in cinnamon sugar. And because they taste exactly like a lovely cinnamon donut, they're easy, and they have... pantry staples in it. You don't need any special
ingredients. They
are kid
pleasers.
Oh, exactly.
Cinnamon and sugar is kind
you
of
coat
a,
anything I mean, in butter literally and cinnamon you, sugar. Yeah, you,
you
dunk
dip
it.
Dip it in melted butter.
Yeah. I'm going to do that when I get home tonight. I'm just going to make muffins.
The muffin or you?
Me, I'm going to just fill my tub up with butter and roll around in a kiddie pool of sugar and cinnamon. Brittany, now that we're kind of on to ingredients, is there a savory breakfast muffin?
Oh, yes.
That's what I just said, the what the bran muffin?
The bran. The bran sort of walked that line, the savory, where you need to add butter to it. And,
icing.
Like squarely
gin.
Savory.
Yes. Anything to make
get
it.
Get drunk and then eat it.
Anything to make it,
down.
It better.
Tequila shot. Sure.
I love a savory muffin. A cornmeal muffin is a really great option. Add some cheese, some herbs. Sometimes we'll add a little bit of squash puree. It's delicious.
Tina just had a cornmeal muffin and she loves that muffin you make at the bakery.
That is a gluten-free Beecher's cheddar and cornmeal muffin.
Yeah, my favorite.
Yeah, muffins are a great vehicle for gluten-free experimentations as well.
Because they already have that crumbly texture.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, those wonderful replacement flours that are on the line right now, they tend to make your baked products a little bit more floofy, which is what we want in a muffin anyway.
Did that answer your question?
That does. Yeah. That does. Like, the idea of something kind of, like, cheesy and herby and more on that side of things is a little bit more what I liked. Not that I don't love a sweet breakfast.
Sure.
Sweet, certainly. But sometimes you want something a little more savory.
Yeah.
And then you can make a batch. Take it to work with you.
Yep.
And they IQF beautifully, right? They
gorgeous. Yes.
Freeze. How do you reheat a muffin out of the freezer that doesn't come out dry and overly crumbly?
I use Chef Mike, the microwave. I know that's terrible, but it works really well.
Who's Chef Mike?
a frozen cake or muffin, you know, something small like that, 30 seconds in the microwave. Yeah. I do it for my son all the time. You've got a beautiful muffin right before you.
You don't get up in the morning and make your son fresh
muffins? I don't. I know. I'm a terrible mother.
Before you go work your full-time job in restaurant week. It's weird.
So disappointing. Are you going to hang with us for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia?
Yeah, let's do it.
Up next, Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Tom is taking on the two ladies, and he's going to win. Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.